C-74. Stevenson Farm, East View, Colorado. 3 miles south of Birchwood, Richard Walker sat pensively at the kitchen table of the cottage which had once been his second home and was now his only refuge from a hostile world. The picturesque cornfield vistas and relative privacy despite its proximity to the city had been Walker's motivations for choosing this cottage over his other options, and he had never regretted the decision for a minute. Only a handful of people knew where Walker lived, and he was equally confident for varying reasons that each would stay quiet. The first was Joe Crabb, a long-term ally who continued to deliver essential supplies every 2 weeks. Joe knew where Walker lived, but he didn't know what had happened there. He didn't know anything. Joe didn't know that Walker's cover-up was a hoax, much less that his lies had come true when real aliens furtively sabotaged DS-1's launch to prevent the nuclear weaponization of space. And Joe certainly didn't know that those aliens had taken Walker, the man whose lies led to the launch of DS-1 in the first place, and thus necessitated the initial intervention. And told him that any attempts to destabilize the world further with an admission of his lie would result in a second and permanent abduction. As time passed, Walker had grown progressively less sure that the aliens had been serious about their threat. It struck him as highly unlikely that they were still keeping tabs after so much time, but he hadn't yet felt an urgent need to test this in any way. On occasion, he had been tempted to bring Joe in on the secret to ensure that the option of revealing it didn't die with him, but on reflection, he realized that Joe had so little mainstream credibility that he would have been as well, scrawling "Walker lied it was a hoax" in brown paint on the wall of an abandoned warehouse. The only other three people who knew Walker's current location were the same three who knew everything else, the McCarthy brothers and Emma Ford. All three continued to surprise him greatly by remaining strong enough and selfless enough to keep it all quiet. Events of the last few days had left Walker feeling uncomfortably and intolerably impotent. For decades, he had enjoyed real power in frontline politics, first as a congressman and ultimately as the long-standing head of the Interspace Defense Agency. But right now, those days seemed a long way away. His elaborate plan to sell a hoax by dressing the lie up as a secret had succeeded in its primary goal of halting China's ambitious plans to colonize the moon and walk on the surface of Mars, two developments which, to his mind, would have unacceptably ceded the ultimate high ground and, in his famous words, surrendered the well-earned national security advantage of the United States. The unfortunate side effect of the hoax, from Walker's point of view, had been the creation of the GSC, a truly supranational organization which brought all national space agencies together under one umbrella. Power creep had always been his main concern when it came to such organizations, and the one saving grace in his eyes was that the GSC at least had a strongly pro-West leader in the form of William Godfrey, whose occasional anti-American comments of the past Walker knew to have been strategic rather than authentic. Nevertheless, Walker wanted the GSC to die yesterday. When a meteor entered the Earth's atmosphere and exploded with tremendous force high above the island of Kerguelen, the people of Earth had been powerless to stop it. And with the United States fully signed up to the GSC's charter, all unilateral defensive measures were out of the question. It disgusted Walker that a rich European like Timo Fiori was doing more than President Slater to safeguard the people of the United States and the world at large. Walker didn't buy the theories that the Kerguelen bolide was anything but a coincidence. He also didn't buy the theory that it was a close call, as many had been calling it. Like Tunguska and Chelyabinsk, he saw it instead as a warning for humanity to get its act together. A meteor today, and what tomorrow? Walker was asking the question, but it seemed to him like no one else was. And if things continued the way they were going, with a corrupt and bloated GSC prohibiting anyone else from doing anything to protect the planet while its mechanisms did the square root of nothing, he would have no choice but to do something. At 4 a.m., he decided it was time for a test run. Walker coughed dryly, grimacing and holding the throat, which had recently begun to fail him so completely. His loyal old dog, Rooster, walked to his side as he always did when the coughing got bad. Walker patted the dog's head and told him it was okay. He then picked up his phone and dialed Joe Crabb's number. It rang and rang, but there was no answer. "One of these days," he said after the beep, coughing again to clear his treacherous throat, and in doing so destroying his initial effort to sound intimidating. "One of these days or nights, I'm going to need you to answer on the first ring so we can set up an urgent live interview. You know I don't have many days left, Joe. What you don't know is that there's something I want to get off my chest before the last one comes."